I promised I would look and find the Status Confessione statement, and I looked around and found out I did not bring it with me. But then I found John Schramm, who had received the report on the, and this is the report on the Lutheran World Federation's meeting in Dar es Salaam. And it includes that statement on Status Confessione. So I'd like to read it to you to begin, and as a way as also catching up with and a little review kind of a way, and from with yesterday and moving into today. Under normal circumstances, Christians may have different opinions in political questions. However, political and social systems might become perverted and oppressive so that it is consistent with the confession to reject them and to work for change. We especially appeal to our white member churches in Southern Africa to recognize that the situation in Southern Africa constitutes a status confessionis. This means, this is the significant sentence, this means that on the basis of faith and order, and excuse me, on the basis of faith and in order to manifest the unity of the church, churches would publicly and unequivocally reject the existing apartheid system. Now you can hear it contains all the kind of things we talked about yesterday, for those of you who were here, that it's not saying, you know, it's saying that normal circumstances, we really struggle and pray together about many political questions, and there is no, not necessarily any unity in them. Around the communion table, we have another kind of unity that doesn't depend upon our having our claims to be right. But at times, very, very unusual times throughout history, certain particular issues become so critically important in our relationship to the world that it becomes a matter of our confession of Christ to be unanimous in rejecting something. The pinch of altar on the, rather the pinch of incense on the altar of the emperor in the early Christian days, the confessing church in the time of Hitler, and now this. Is that enough? We talked a lot about that yesterday. I don't think we need to go into great detail, further discussion of it. I'd be glad to talk to anybody about it more. It's only because of my disorganization that I didn't have that to read to you yesterday.
Was the Vietnam War one of these?
No. Would I have liked Vietnam War to have become one of them? Yes. What it was not. This is the first time in modern history that Status Confessionis has been publicly invoked, other than in World War II. It'd be interesting to discuss whether Vietnam War should have been or was, in fact, if we recognize it. After the fact, or as I suggested yesterday, it'd be an interesting discussion about looking into the future, at what points in Christians stand against the excessive, consuming destructiveness of our culture, at what points we approach a status confessionis as Christians.
May I see it, please, Joe?
Sure. Okay. What I'd like to do today, and is this is sort of a wrap-up session in a way for those of you who have not been, who have been taking part for four sessions in this. I don't want to make it a useless session for people, however, who are coming here for the first time. But I would like to not fill it with my heavy agenda. I have a few things I'd like to talk about, and then we have one thing that we said yesterday we would talk about, and I've asked Leo to sit down here rather than up there today so he could share in that, and that is questions about violence and the faith, particularly in relationship to Southern Africa, but it has to apply also to us. But I'd like to, before getting into any of that, ask ahead of time if there's anything you have on your mind that you wanted to make sure got talked about today, and we'll allot time for it. Any questions or areas of discussion that if you've been in here for other sessions, that you wanted to make sure got talked about.
I've really been wondering, and I know that, you know, the Soweto is not publicized very much, but how come it hasn't been publicized more? In that, I would think it would be a challenge to any, you know, any really good reporter to even to want to get in there and to expose it, and why it hasn't been, or if we're just not really that concerned, and it has been, or what is the history on that, the exposure of Soweto, the ghetto?
Okay. Anything else?
I don't know how to put this, and I don't want it to sound too critical, but I want to know, in your observations, if you saw something good that the whites did in South Africa, what are doing there now?
I may touch on that in some introductory remarks I want to make, but if I don't, we'll make sure we pick it up as a special question towards the end.
We all know the Romeo and Juliet story, and I was wondering if it's possible for a black to fall in love with a white South African.
Legally? I mean...
Just a romance. Is it possible?
Yeah, that's easy to answer, just right off. Yeah, it happens a lot. Most of them, if they want to do anything about it, have to leave the country. I mean, all of them, if they want to do anything about it beyond a secret romance, have to leave the country. And there's a very interesting thing happened in relationship to that, is that an Anglican priest, a black Anglican priest from Namibia, not from South Africa, but where those same laws have been enforced, left the country for other reasons, came to Brooklyn or someplace, anyway, that's where he was living with his wife, fell in love with a white woman and married her, and now has been elected suffragan bishop of the Anglican Church of Namibia. Went back 3 weeks ago, and Namibia and South Africa has in an effort to retreat defensively, is relaxing those rules and has let them come in. So for the first time publicly in the history of Namibia, or in the history of whole South Africa, public allowance of a mixed marriage, and not just a normal mixed marriage, but of the suffragan bishop, and the bishop himself is in exile, so he will be the suffragan will be the highest authority of the Anglican Church in Namibia, is a mixed marriage, married to a white woman. And that's just going to blow everybody's minds. I don't know how long it's going to last.
What's a suffragan?
Not the marriage, I mean, suffragan bishop in the Catholic Church is like an assistant bishop. Okay, most of these questions I was going to answer later, but I just get that in there. Anybody else have anything they wanted to make sure got raised, answered? Okay, I'd like to take maybe 10 minutes to talk about the advertised subject of the day, the effect of the struggle on the United States. And I don't have to say too much in that, because yesterday, mostly, but also other days, we've been talking about that. So I just would like to add a couple of comments, and then spend as much time as we need on the subject of violence, and we can go forever and ever on that, but to maybe take 15 minutes or so on that, and then come back to some of these other questions. Okay? When I think of the question of the struggle in South Africa, or Southern Africa in general, on the United States, I think primarily of two things, although there's lots and lots of other areas that could be spoken of. And I might remind you that in terms of my personal interest in Southern Africa, it's that question that I'm mostly interested in. I didn't go to Southern Africa or to South Africa to become an expert on that issue. And I have not become an expert on that issue. I did not go there in order that I could switch issues and take on a new one and now spend the whatever time of the future primarily focusing on liberation. How can I contribute to the liberation of South Africa, although I think that's an important question, and I certainly do want to be interested in that. But my primary question has to do with what my main vocation is. And my main vocation and within the church, or vocation is a bad word, because I think my main vocation, as I understand it, is to be a pastor. But my primary specialist interest in the church is the combating of racism in the United States, and especially within the context of the mission of the church in urban areas. So that doesn't sound immediate like it has any reason for going to South Africa. But my main belief is that we in the United States are being changed more by forces outside the country, international reality, than we are by internal reality, and especially in the struggle of third world peoples for liberation. And within the church, we in the church in the United States are being, I believe, and will be even more so, more affected in our understanding of the gospel by what brothers and sisters around the world in third world countries are learning about the gospel than by our own internal forces within. So I really believed then when I went, and it was certainly reinforced, and I believe now that we will be, as a people and as a church, tremendously affected by the struggle in Southern Africa. I would say that it's not an exaggeration to put it this way, that we will be as much affected in the next 10 years by the struggles in Southern Africa as we were in the last 10 years by the struggles in Vietnam. And you know how much we were affected by the Vietnam. And I believe that the struggles in Southern Africa could easily reach that proportion of affecting us and our lives. So clearly, one of the ways one could talk about the affecting us is if we act as, and this is out of my profound conviction, you may disagree with me as much as you wish about this, if we act as stupid towards South Africa as we did towards Vietnam, which people in Southern Africa and many people in the United States find a very likely scenario, we will be very much affected by it. That the possibility of going even so far as committing troops in Southern Africa almost became a reality in the Zaire crisis just 2 months ago, when President Carter seriously talked about how do we arm the people of Zaire against Angola, and that's right into Southern Africa. And even talked about how do we get around the arms embargo and for President Carter to supply arms any longer to Southern Africa has to go through Congress. So he was talking about how do you get around that, and he doesn't need permission from Congress to supply arms to the Middle East, and so Saudi Arabia agreed to take the weapons we supplied to Saudi Arabia and supply them to Zaire with no permission needed from Congress. And that was openly talked about as an open option. And then there was a sudden switch, and then suddenly President Carter became buddies for a while, at present at least, with President Neto of Angola. And I don't know where it goes from that. But that the committing of troops to Southern Africa is a talked about option, and that within the context of where we are as a nation now, any taking sides in South Africa will be with the whites. And it requires a change in our total stance with regards to Southern Africa before we remove ourselves to the other side. All right, so that's very clearly, the one can talk about that kind of a powerful effect on us if it becomes the next place where we and Russia fight it out on somebody else's football field. The two elephants find another hen house. There's an old African adage that I can't remember the exact context of, but it's something about every man for himself, said the elephant in the hen house, or something like that. It goes another place for us to carry out our battles, another field. Leaving that scenario aside, though, I'd just like to suggest two ways in which we will still be profoundly affected by that struggle in South Africa. And one is just simply in our struggle to combat racism in the United States, both in terms of black and white people. If you aren't already aware of it, you should try to become even more aware of how much black people in our country identify with that struggle in Southern Africa. How much on a deep gut level those struggles are identified, of the struggle against white domination in South Africa and the struggle against white domination in the United States, in the guts of black people in the United States. Every place I go in black communities, they know what's taking place there, not only just simply as another struggle someplace else, but as part of the same struggle that they're involved in. What happens in Southern Africa will profoundly affect the next stage of black efforts for justice in the United States. And I don't want to become the prophet who can predict anything that happens to that. It just seems to me very obvious that a bloodbath in Southern Africa against the blacks by the whites can only have a tremendous effect. Our struggles in the civil rights movement in the 60s had a tremendous effect on them. That much of the black consciousness movement, much of the black theological basis for Christians to be thinking there, was learned from the struggle here in the United States. That same communication, that communication system is two-way. And black people in the United States will, both in terms of whether it is a successful struggle, to whatever extent it is successful, and to whatever extent it is a bloody catastrophe, will in both ways have a tremendous effect on us in the United States, as black people in the United States. Likewise, the struggle, however way it goes, can have a tremendous effect on our own white consciousness. I do not think it is at all far-fetched for us in our guts, and I also don't think it's all unnatural for us in our guts to find some kind of a strange quivering in our stomachs about that last white enclave of colonialism in the world. The last place of white domination, the last holdout, and it's a winner. I mean, it's a holdout above all holdouts. It is such a holdout that the church has declared it part of the confession of the church to be opposed to it. And that's got to have some kind of an effect on our guts. Not only because of our identification with white people here and the fear and guilt that we have in relationship to racism here, but to have some kind of identity, even with the bad guys, because in a racial sense, and we have been so trained to think racially, in a racial sense, they are our cousins. And they are also greatly filled with fear about being overrun because of the evil that they have done. So there's got to be some kind of, and I'm not even sure what all that means. I just want to suggest that finding some solution to that has a tremendous effect on our own consciousness about what it means to be not only white people who are in the majority in the United States, but in our learning to live as a minority in the world. What the white South Africans are in South Africa, we are in relationship to the whole world, both in terms of domination and in terms of numbers. One could begin to respond at that point to your question, you know, can you talk about South Africans in terms of good? can't we find something positive to say about them? The same thing could be said in terms of all of the critical things that's being said by us, about us in relationship to the whole world. By me and a lot of other people, by you, by many of you, can't we find something good to say about us? And that what that really reflects, probably more than anything else, is your desire and my desire to be a part of something creative, part of something that isn't just simply destructive. Now that I've restated your question, you nodded your head. I don't want to answer it. I don't know how to answer that. I really don't. I don't know how to answer it non-defensively, you know, as a way of saying, you know, how can I, you know, find some saving grace. I have to certainly look at it within the context of the gospel that says that that starts from the standpoint of all of us finding our goodness in something that is given to us as a gift.
think my question was something like, in solving a problem, you need to look at an issue from all sides. And this is what I'm getting at.
The black South Africans that I listened to as carefully as I could never failed to say, and not just because they were talking to a white person, because I listened to them talking to each other. And I've read things out of which they're talking to each other which weren't even necessarily intended for white ears, never failed to say that the future South Africa depends upon finding some way of making use of the good and the skills of black and white people alike. And that that to look at white people as having just as much potentiality for contributing to the good of South Africa as black people. Because white people are African also. And black people never, that I listen to in South Africa, stand up and say, South Africa is for black people and white people cannot be African. But recognize that for 400 years, white people have been African. It's hard to answer that question because of the prison that white people and black people are in alike, and it's a prison created by white people. And a prison that's very hard to look at and talk about in good terms. I don't know much more to say to that. I just know that that white people in South Africa and white people in the United States, and not just white people, but the predominantly white, but also many other races, part of the rich West, will be tremendously affected by what happens there. I think I'll stop with that and just give chance for some reaction from you about that, and then we'll switch to the new second subject, the subject of violence. But respond to that if you'd like.
You keep saying we're going to be tremendously affected. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how we're going to be affected by it?
Mostly because I don't know. I don't think that's a cop out. In 1960 or even 63, some people might have been capable to look at the way our nation would be torn apart in the next 10 years by Vietnam. I couldn't, and even if I could have, and I couldn't at the time, but if I could have even made a statement like I just made about Southern Africa, that we are really going to be tremendously affected by the war in Vietnam in the next 10 years, and somebody asked me, can you say how? I don't think I would have been, obviously the one possible scenario is that we will be torn apart internally in the same way that we were torn apart by Vietnam. But I would like to also think of some of that also being a positive kind of experience for us too.
George,
some of you might want to make some guesses about that.
On a personal level, if I follow this through, if the Pacific Northwest Conference and our local church adopted this, what the Lutheran World Federation says, then 5 years from now, if our church did adopt this, and 5 years from now, there is violent revolution, and our government elects to send troops in support of apartheid, then I, by my personal conviction, cannot support my own government's stand. Is that not true? Do you follow that through?
Well,
I'm then put in a position of by my own conviction, I cannot support my government's action, which is not unforeseeable in what you've just said to me.
We don't belong to a church that can dictate our beliefs, and so I would want to take it somewhere off of the level of your being required to believe something, and put it more on the level of what are the implications of that, at least as a statement of as a national church. And put it on that level, I think that that's probably true. Yeah, that the implications of that are, and that's so filled with all kind of risky things, because if South Africa sucks us into supporting militarily their struggle for their survival, it will be done by our buying into their rhetoric about anti-communism. That's how we got sucked into Vietnam too. But yes, certainly that's the directions that the implications of that go. I believe that it doesn't just apply to South Africa, that it applies to to any nation, any national, any area in which, any way in which we are involved in supporting that system or are involved in that system from any part of the world. An analogy to that would have to be something about the application of Status Confessionis by the Confessing Church in Germany. That was an easy question for us to answer because we were opposed to Germany.
Would you expand a little on what you just mentioned about communism and related to South Africa?
South Africa has learned well and applied to an even more exaggerated degree than has happened in our nation, like in the 50s with the McCarthy era, an even more exaggerated degree of that. They have learned to get people on their side and to excuse their violent excesses by labeling anything that opposes them as communism. Anything, any opposition to the apartheid system, the segregated system of South Africa is labeled as communist. And every listen to every appeal that comes from spokespersons from South Africa, Prime Minister Forster, and all of the other the other persons who speak. There's in last week's U.S. News and World Report. There's an interview with Mulder, a man by the name of Mulder, who's high up in the government, and all of their appeal to us is associating being the last defense against the communist onslaught in South in the world, and identifying them as sort of the last holdouts, and that it's to the self-interest of the United States and Europe to be on their side and make sure that communism does not take over there. It's incredible. All of many of their most terrifying laws, which permit the government to use almost any form of access to control without due legal process, come under the anti-communism laws.
Then who is supposedly the communist threat? Is it working through the black people, or is that what they say?
Well, it's like the excesses here, if you, especially in the 50s, that you don't have to define that very carefully. but obviously the implication is black. The most important application of it is black people. But then they talk vaguely about outside agitators and Russian arms and the teaching of anti-capitalistic and the identification of Marxism with every form of. They managed to take of all the major acts of repression of organizations in the last 20 years in South Africa, they have managed to label them as communists before suppressing them. I think so. If somebody wanted to speak more to that.
You're talking about communism. Would you say then that I agree with you on this, but I wanted to restate it differently. Would you say that Russia is not exploiting the situation down there for revolution? Or do you feel that they are there, but it's still not something that is on that wide scale? I mean, there must be some element of the truth, but it maybe only be 5%.
Yeah, I think that starting from the rest of Africa first and responding to that it's very clear, and some of you heard me tell my elephant story the other day, mm-hmm. that in many other parts of Africa, that those two elephants have chosen places to fight out and to accuse each other. Of being there for selfish interest purposes, and from my point of view, both being right. Within the context of South Africa, and I can only speak from what I learned there, and there may be secret agents who can tell more accurate, but from everything I learned, that it was more myth than fiction that Russia had gotten that far in infiltrating South Africa. That the infiltration is clearly us, not them, but on the other side. But it's clearly only a matter of time. And that's not the defense of Russia. It's clearly only a matter of time that the vacuum will be taken up by Russia, China, the Second World, in terms of taking sides. It's exactly what happened in Vietnam. In 1947, Ho Chi Minh in San Francisco, 46, Ho Chi Minh in San Francisco at the founding of the United Nations and in succeeding year, begged the United Nations and the United States to sign with the United Nations of being on their side for the independence of Vietnam from France because of their loyalty and their taking of the side against Japan in the World War II and because of their anti-colonialist position. They wanted to be free of France. And Ho Chi Minh had Lincoln was his greatest hero. And he had on his model constitution for Vietnam was the United States Constitution. It had nothing to do with a communist war. And we chose to side with France. And they had and the vacuum was taken up. I just repeat that, apply that to South Africa. I think that it's only a matter of a short time before, if we don't change sides, if we stay and increase the side that we're on, it will only be a matter of time that we will be sucked into to looking at black rebellion in South Africa and seeing it supported by the people we have chosen to be enemies in Europe.
Did that same thing happen in China with Mao, too?
In a much more complicated kind of way, and a way in which I don't know that.
He tried to make contact with us, and we turned our nose up. Is that right? And
it's a much more complicated process about which I don't know as much, but but essentially I think that's true.
The United States historically has really decided or joined the sides of those that would protect its economic interests. Primarily, I think Vietnam would be an example, supporting the government there no matter how repressive because it supplies the materials that it needs, and which has really created a lot of the greatness that this country right now has. So I would imagine there's going to have to be a great internal struggle in the United States here to change that philosophy. I think everyone here would be affected by it. I think we would have to live on less than what we have, but there'd be a lot more justice in the world.
One of the things that's on our side in that is that our rhetoric, our philosophy as a nation, is not on that side. Our philosophy as a nation, in principles, is that we'd be on the side that we haven't been on. And that my sadness and sickness, and I think of many of us, is that we still believe in what the principles of our nation is, but our nation constantly comes down on the wrong side.
Through the economic industry.
Yes. I'm going to do no more than two questions more in this, because here and then over there, you want to change subject, but one more, and then we want to get to violence.
I didn't have a question. I just wondered if you could talk about violence.
Okay, good. One more question over here, then, and we'll change the subject.
The thing to me, the concept of collective responsibility, whereby we as Americans, or me as an individual, just as responsible as Hitler was for the extermination of 6 million Jews, or that I, as a person, I'm just as responsible as, or I'm responsible for people being in prison, either through inaction or some kind of action, that I, too, am responsible, and that I am responsible as well as South Africans for the atrocities that happened there, and that I have to share in that responsibility. Is this thing that we're kind of, that we ought to be driving for? This is sort of a personal decision that we should make in terms of what stance we will take on this issue. Is this what you're espousing to?
Yeah, I think so. I think that one of the places where our faith is most in tension, in conflict with our culture, is on the level of individualism, where it's become practiced, individualism espoused and practiced so much in our culture. And invaded even so much of our churches, where we've lost sight of the nature of collective corporateness and communion, which we celebrate in relation to the church, the creation, our oneness with nature. And also, it also gets applied in the need for somehow to deal with the fact that you can't just cop out and say, I didn't bomb Vietnam, and blame it on the pilot. Or I did, that somehow can't just simply by saying, I will not oppress Africa any longer. It's important that we develop lifestyles that are not that are less oppressive on a personal level. But that companion to that is our being able to see that that does not make us innocent in the corporate level. And a term I like to use, which I want to really do some dialoguing with Walter Capps about this too, because they're so much comparable, so much in agreement with each other, is what it means to be a dissenting oppressor, which doesn't deny who I am, but puts me in a position where I can begin to struggle with making us who more like we should be. And I think that's very comparable, or is directly related to his phrase of positive disengagement. Some people have been saying, by the way, that, gee, Walter Capps and I have been talking in such opposite kinds of ways, and we don't think that. We think that we talk in such complementary kinds of ways, and we may do a couple of discussion sessions yet available for people who want to struggle with that together with us, a chance to see the way the two kind of things we're talking about being very much comparable to each other. Or two aspects of the same thing. But yeah, I think we have to struggle with corporate responsibility and collective change.
That was the first shot, okay. Joe, did you just hear
it? Yeah, right. Well, I don't have any special way to begin this. We began it yesterday. I mentioned that the question that I met more and more repeatedly, most repeatedly in South Africa amongst the young people, was the question of how the relationship between the Christian faith, my Christian faith, and my identification with the struggle for liberation in South Africa, which is bound to become violent. They will be pulled more and more towards identification with a violent revolution, and what that means in terms of their Christian faith. There have been there's been a lot of commentary, especially in Europe, even more than the United States, about that, especially because one man by the name of Bernard, I think his first name is, Sholama, in the World Council of Churches Program to Combat Racism, in January of this year, put out a paper saying, almost advocating from the outside that the time for the violent revolution has come, and the Christian Church must be on the side of that violent revolution, and we need to. What he advocated is that we ask the question how our concepts that we've used historically to justify war, our concepts of just war, can be applied to the concept of just rebellion. Then his writing that paper caused such a flurry of reaction, so strong in the opposite way. Unfortunately, not really raising the question of nonviolent change, but a very reactionary, racist reactions. And it raises the question for us, we as a people and as a church have always so readily given in to violent solutions, whether it was the Revolutionary War in the United States, all the way through towards to the present time where such a high percentage of our economy is consented to and supported by us in either passive or active ways as violently solving the world's problems or violently protecting ourselves from solutions we don't agree with. And it raised the question yesterday as I spoke of this, being a terrific kind of a problem that South African people are facing now, but not too far different from the problem that we should be facing too. And it brought about a response in Leo, and especially kind of ricocheted off of his statement he heard from me the day before that, saying, I'm a pacifist. And so we thought we'd just open that for discussion today, that we sit side by side while we're talking about it, not from up there, but that it be not just between us, but all of us. I think I've said enough. All I want to say is as an introduction to the question, so that I don't sort of direct what we talk about, the question of violence as Christians in the solving of world's problems, especially South Africa and ours. don't know if you wanted to say something to begin, you're free to, or anybody else is free to.
Well, I'm not happily sitting here. This is, as you probably recognize, this is a very emotional thing with me, and it's very exhausting. And last night, during the night, I woke up at 2:30 in terror. And my experiences in the war and in the underground are of that nature, so that when I discuss it, there are repercussions. Many times in the last many decades, I wake up in terror. And so it's very exhausting. I mentioned yesterday that I was very well trained in how to kill. My experiences in the prison camp and my association with the underground, and the association, limited associations I had, I was of such a nature that when I returned, and this is the first time I'm ever telling this. My wife doesn't know it, or anyone knows it. I reasoned that sometime we may have to do this again, and I want some people that I can trust who will not, under any circumstance, ever cross me up. This is very important in the underground. You've got to die before you expose yourself or anyone else. In all these decisions, you must examine yourself as not only what it'll do to you, but what it'll do to whatever cause it is, but your family and others. And I went so far as to make a list of those people that I would I could turn to and trust with my life. The list wasn't very long. Now a number of things have happened. Somebody gave me a Dean's pencil. This is a Dean's pencil. It has very little lead and a lot of eraser. And as one goes through life, one gains experience and perhaps and hopefully knowledge, and you do change your mind. Now, I'm violent, I think, by nature, you know. I support Amnesty International. When you support Amnesty International, you support people and try to get them rescued, only in the sense that they have not advocated violent action. They're prisoners of conscience. Now this is hard for me, as right now I'm drafting a letter, because my assignment, you're assigned other countries. My assignment now, it happens to be Argentina, where 15,000 people have disappeared in the last 2 years. Thousands have been incarcerated, imprisoned, terrible torture. I won't go into it. It's the kind that Joe has been telling us, and I don't want to divert from South Africa, but I'm just telling you this. And when I read this, I become very intense and say, killing is too good for them. Huh? And you'd like to get out there and tear them up. One of the people that I would have trusted was named John Gruen. He and I have shared things in prison camp that we have probably shared with no other. And he would trust me with his life, and I would trust him with my life. 4 years ago, he had a medical service drugstore in Lake City, up in Seattle. I visited him in his home. About 4 or 5 years ago, our visits haven't been that frequent. And he'd been robbed, and they had taken his Luger. And he wanted to know where he could find the Luger. If I knew where he could get a Luger, if I knew where 60 Lugers would have been, I wouldn't have told him. Well, 2 years ago, this last March, I called him up in his medical service pharmacy, because that's where I get a lot of my drugs.
2 years ago, this last March, I called him up in his medical service pharmacy because that's where I get a lot of my drugs. I'm not shooting him. And Nell answered the phone. Nell is his wife. And Nell said, I said, how's business? Oh, pretty good. I said, have you got John hidden away there somewhere? Oh, she says, you haven't heard? I says, heard what? He was killed in a holdup 4 days before Christmas. The story on it was that on about December 11th or 12th, someone came to hold him up. And he only wanted soft drugs, so he gave them to him, but he followed him out with his Luger and shot at him, but he missed. And so the same person, probably, along with another one, came on December 21st to get him. They waited for Nell to leave, and they got him. He who lives by the Luger dies by the Luger. I have come to respect the nature of people like Gandhi, Martin Luther King, although it's very difficult for me. I've already told you how Amnesty International feels. I can't read Matthew 25 without saying that person is in prison. That person in prison is Jesus. And doesn't say that he isn't there because he belongs there either. He belongs there. So every life is precious. In fact, it's Jesus. So that weighs very heavily on me. And I also remind you that if Jesus on the cross would have said, they got me, but I'm going to get them, we'd have been through with it. And so I then, my position, you think these out. No, it's your decision, not mine. I mean, we have to make these for ourselves. I told yesterday, and Dietrich Bonhoeffer made that decision for himself as a pacifist, as one of the great pacifists of our country, and your assigned reading is The Cost of Discipleship. He reveals it there. And I'm not so sure that history will be kind to him as to what he did, except you don't know until you find out whether you succeed or fail. And they failed. And he lost his life for it. But it was when you decide when you're going to get the mad truck driver, when you give up patching the people up that he's run over, and finally decide to get the truck driver. You better pick your truck drivers very carefully, but resort to all means you can, short of taking life, or when you take them, take the least number. And why we got good heads is to figure out some of these things. And I said, give me a few hundred men or 1,000 well trained. I could shut down this country. And I think the blacks already figured that out several years ago, how they could do it. They are conveniently located in the marshalling yards and the power plants and so forth, by the railroad tracks. I spent many months and night after night figuring out how to get those bastards, how to cross them up. At the least risk to myself.
So you could not support a violent revolution, is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying. It depends on the circumstance, but I'd do a lot of searching before I did it. But when I did it, I was ready. I'd be ready like the underground, and you know how many of them operated. You carried several grenades, so that when they were going to take you and it looked like it was all gone, you pulled the pins so that you took as many of them with you as you could. If quite obvious in our the way we play tricks with our words in our cultures and in our societies, that one person's guerrilla fighter is another person's terrorist. You know, it depends who, what side you're reporting on. And I have some, you know, come from wherever you are on this reaction, Leo said, out of what you've been thinking about in terms of South Africa, or out of your own experience.
I've been pretty fascinated with the philosophy of Gandhi and King, you know, the passive resistance type thing. I was wondering how possible or probable that is in the situation of South Africa. Is it a unique situation that the white government is just too violent itself, that passive resistance is impossible? Or is it possible, like the civil rights movement of the 60s here?
Many, many people have speculated on the fact that there's one other way in which, besides our withdrawing our support from South Africa so that they couldn't survive, the one other means by which South Africa would stop being able to function is if the blacks just sat down. Everything that the country was built, is built, functions on the supposition of docility of black people. And Frederick Douglass said that it requires two people for oppression to take place, the oppressor and the permission of the oppressed. I suppose that's theoretically true. Mahatma Gandhi developed all of his philosophy and all of his practices and out of a basis of his experience in South Africa. Whether that's a functionally true thing, whether it's theoretically possible or functionally possible, has got to be a decision of South African people in a very, very short period of time. I don't know.
Has it been tried at all?
Well, the resistance to the government of South Africa has been a non-violent resistance. It has not been developed campaign, a movement, as Gandhi developed it in India, or as it was attempted to be developed here in the 60s.
You talked the other day very strongly about withdrawing our money from banks or South Africa. Well, what it generally ends up with, putting the money where your mouth is. What can we do with some of that money to support that cause?
It's a difficult question to answer, except from one perspective. It's difficult because there are no innocent banks, you know, in terms of, you know, just. But there is such a thing as a symbolic campaign. During the farm worker movement in California, certain manufacturers or growers were selected out as symbolic targets, and nobody said that they were more guilty necessarily than others who weren't being boycotted, but that symbolic targets were necessary. And in that sense, there have been 8, I believe, key targeted banks for withdrawal from. If your money is in those banks, the first requirement, you know, what's being asked on a first level is to withdraw your money from those banks and just put it in any other bank. There are other people who say, though, that you should find there's a couple of types of banks that are very important that are happening in our country, especially in our urban areas, and one of them is our minority banks. Now, minority banks, in terms of our economic system, are no purer, but in terms of the self-interests of black people in particular kinds of development, that can be, or in New York, we have a First Woman's Bank, and a lot of people are advocating that money be put in that, but at least it'll be removed for banks which are most implicated in the.
I meant more in contributing to the cause of giving some of that money to where we can give it.
I want to sell all you have and give it to the poor. I'm not. The supporting of any of these groups here, except for the last one, I'm not asking for money, are very, very important ones. Another one I would think is one of my favorites, because it's always under target because of its courage, is the Program to Combat Racism of the World Council of Churches. The Office on World Community in terms of Lutheran Church programs. And then if you want to give money directly to programs within South Africa that are programs of resistance, then I would write to the Office of World Community and say that to Dr. Ed May. And so you want your money to go to some place which will support the struggle for liberation in South Africa, and he'd be glad to suggest some ways to do that.
Along on that question, the thing that's most interesting to me of this situation, maybe this to other people, you mentioned the other day that all over the world there are people from South Africa, blacks, that are being trained for future leadership, that are now in exile, and they're being trained for future leadership in the universities, and then when the revolution takes place, they'll come back over. Who is paying for that? That's not free. Where are they getting this money to come out and go to Harvard and, you know, Wisconsin?
I don't know the full answer to that. I would guess that there are three major answers to that. Mm-hmm. Four major answers. The United Nations, mm-hmm. the United States, and European countries, Russia, and second world countries, and other African nations.
Mm-hmm.
They come from at least all those four majors. That's a very general answer.
So there's no fund or no scholarship situation set up for.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm sorry, I just missed a major thing, and that is, well, mm-hmm. when I included the United States and Europe, the Lutheran World Federation's Department of Studies. Our church's Department of Studies, excuse me for missing a very important answer to that. The same department that sent me to Africa provides a large number of scholarships, presently, especially in terms of Namibia, for a tremendous number of scholarships, making it possible for Namibians to have, and South Africans as well,
mm-hmm.
to get educations in Africa, as well as in Europe and the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for pushing me on that. I really goofed on answering that. And is another area of the possible use of money also.
Sure. I'm a little bit, I know, not really disturbed. I think we're going to spend a lot of time in the conversation because of the comment of where I'm going. I'm not sure it's something about, I believe it was just about passive resistance in terms of God in particular. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I can't come at nonviolence to Christianity because the church has been, in my experience, too much of a violent institution. Psychologically, if not physically. And yet, I think it's important when you talk of nonviolence, at least in terms of Gandhi or Martin Luther King, to realize that Satyagraha, Gandhi's name for his form of nonviolence, did not mean passive resistance. It means true force, and it is seen as a viable means of evoking change, which comes out of a commitment to God, to truth itself. And therefore, I think it's a misconception to talk about really as passive resistance, a very active thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you said that. We were talking yesterday also about resistance as an active word within the context of the faith. It's not a negative but a positive concept. And so passive or nonviolent resistance is not sitting down and doing nothing. It is actively taking part in the opposing and working for change. It's very important. This is not an easy subject to get into. I think I feel in the silence a lot of struggle with these questions, and not just
in the beginning of our well, in the settling of the West and so forth, we seem to have made a mistake about Indians, of classifying them all as the same, and all of them if there was any enmity from the Indians, it would be toward the whites. And we forgot about the fact that they were separate little tribes that had as much violent attitude toward each other as they did toward the whites. Now, is the situation in Africa in any way comparable to that? For instance, the Sioux and the Blackfeet didn't get along. They take each other.
Well, we've been, by human nature, the development of the world has gone through all kinds of tribal relationships and caught up in both the negative and positive aspects of tribalism. And I'm not an anthropologist, and I can't say much about that. But as I said yesterday, I think probably that one could talk about the tribal relationships, both in positive and negative ways, in Africa is the same way as you can talk about the tribal relationships between Norway and Sweden in both positive and negative aspects, or of all of the European tribes and the long, violent, bitter struggles and moving and great catastrophe here makes a tribe move south and get on somebody else's turf and it's going to bring about conflict and religious conflict is an old thing. And one can, you can talk about tribal relationships in Africa as the same way as you can talk about our European tribal relationships in our history. The important thing to recognize in the United States in relationship to Native America and in Africa in relationship to that tribal things is the way in which that tribal relationships and differences were used and exaggerated and turned against each other in order that we could conquer. And that's what we're really living with, and I think really needs to be examined, especially as a deliberate program in South Africa.
I think that's very important to point out, for if you weren't here when you mentioned this, that's a very terrible thing they're doing. It's the same thing we did with the Indians.
Yep.
With the Nez Perce very near here. It's a very terrible thing.
I think that maybe just to, I think we, if anybody wants to stay longer, you can. We need to close, and I'd like to just try and make a statement of my own about this, that I really identify with Leo is that my pacifism does not come out of a pacifist nature. I am not nonviolent by nature. I know that. I've gone through the experience of, among other people, with Sarah Pitcher and Al Pitcher and myself together in the movement in Chicago, and many, many other people, of having gone through the training of nonviolence and to go through marches and devastating marches where surrounded by thousands of, maybe a small band of 50 or 100 black and white people, surrounded by thousands of white people who were doing their best to kill us, and to go through the discipline of keeping your hands in your pockets while they're throwing rocks and bottles at you, and of exploding over that and being trained so that when somebody explodes, to surround that person and protect that person from letting that explosion go out and do damage to others. My personal convictions about pacifism have nothing to do with my nature. Have something to do with my experience of nonviolent struggle. Also have something to do with the deception of our people and of all people in the world, not just Americans, not just United States people, of what we use when we talk about words like dying for our country or dying for our cause, and really mean killing for our cause and killing for our country. Nobody ever gets trained in the United States Army to die for our country. We get trained to kill for our country. And that's okay if you want to be honest about it. But I think we need to deal with the reality of what we use, how our patriotism leads us into places where we stop thinking and start acting in ways that have nothing to do with our faith or our desire to be human. The bottom line for me, and I don't know what South Africans should do, I know whose side I'm on, and even if they do something I disagree with, I want to stay on their side, and that's what's important to me, and find out how I can support struggles for freedom. But the bottom line for me is that if we are opposed to violence, and this is where my self-deception comes most, and I've got to constantly correct myself, if I am opposed to violence, then I had better be opposed to my violence, to our violence, and not to the violence of South African liberation forces first, or the violence of black people or brown people or yellow people or anybody struggling for justice in this country. That if we are opposed to violence, anybody's violence, then our primary commitment ought to be disengaging our violence and our violent means of preserving our life and our lifestyle. And that's where it seems to me bottom line comes, And if we're not committed to that, if we're not committed to resisting our violence, then we've lost our ability to make up our minds about anybody else's. That's at least where my bottom line begins. One other thing is going to happen on Africa this week, and it's going to be a film strip tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock on banking on South Africa for people who really want to look at that issue closer. And so I haven't really gone too deeply into that because I know we're going to get into that particular thing. After that, anybody who comes to any of my sessions will probably not be in South Africa anymore, but the area in which I do know, feel like I know a little bit more about, and that is combating racism and doing mission of the church in urban areas in the United States, and that'll be next week. So I've enjoyed talking about Africa with you.